It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 459 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week, three great comics creators are back to talk about their current Kickstarter projects. First up is Ted Sikora from Apama, the Undiscovered Animal, and Tap Dance Killer. He's now got Punchline and the Vaudevillains issue number one coming our way. It's described this way. A heavyweight boxer turned superpowered clown assassin steps into the ring to fight for his very soul. His project will conclude at 11:59 p.m. on Thursday, November 12. Next is Jonathan Thompson from Tales from the Dead Astronaut. His Kickstarter going on right now is for Burn Residue, a comic described this way. It's a crime story about the cost of revenge on the human soul. Of course, there's a lot more to it, and we get into that and discuss it some, but be sure to support his project before Saturday, November 28 at 12 a.m. Eastern Time. Then everything wraps up with the return of Matt Shore from Moby Dick Back from the Deep. We talk about Monster Hunter for Hire, his current Kickstarter, which is described this way. It's a horror anthology comic where each tale has a dark and amusing twist, and it features a monster hunter who finds his job sucks, and he hates it. A little different take on the profession. Be sure to support this excellent comic before the project concludes on Friday, December 4 at 1:43 p.m. Eastern Time. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show.
Punchline and the Vaudevillains is a series that changes on a dime, from horror to superhero to comedy to supernatural. But all of that is grounded in its setting of modern-day Cleveland. At the center of it all is Drayton Hayes, a.k.a. Punchline. He's a heavyweight boxer who was recruited by the Vaudevillains back in Tap Dance Killer number 1 and became a super-powered murderous clown assassin who really knows how to fight.
It's always great to talk with Ted Sikora, the creator of such good things as Apama, which I first ran into in the state of Ohio, appropriately enough, I think in Cleveland. And you have a new book out called Punchline and the Vaudevillains.
Yes, sir.
Vaud hyphen villains, spelled V-I-L-L-A-I-N-S instead of Vaudevillians. That all good stuff. So how you doing, Ted?
I'm doing great, Wayne. How about yourself?
Good. As per usual, Kickstarter is a podcaster's best friend because people are looking for ways to promote their product and stuff like that. And this is a great way to do it. So we have your Kickstarter going on right now, and yours is actually coming to a conclusion pretty soon. Thursday, November 12 at 11:59 p.m. Some people get on me because I never get to the vital stats quick enough for them. So this time I'm getting right to the beginning. We're getting right in it. We're getting it right at the, as we start. It's called, again, Punchline and the Vaudevillains, issue number 1. And let me read the description just so we get all this good stuff out of the way. A heavyweight boxer turned superpowered clown assassin steps into the ring to fight for his very soul. Now, that's something I haven't read before, I have to say. So, Ted, why don't you, you're bringing one of your other characters, one of your better-known characters in. You even did a video of Apama and stuff like that. Let's say people didn't get to hear your previous talk with me. How would you describe Punchline and the Vaudevillains to people who don't know about all these good things?
Oh, so Punchline is about a heavyweight boxer. His name's Drayton Hayes, and he was like the number one contender for the heavyweight title. But then his career was sabotaged by some people close to him. During a fight, his water was poisoned. He got knocked out. Then he failed a drug test because of what they put into his water. So he's down and out when our group of Vaudevillains find him and offer him a chance at revenge, but also giving him enhanced, strength. And he finds them so strange, they sort of kidnap him and take him into this sort of science lab. And they show him this woman, Hurricane Lizzie, and what she's able to do by putting her hand into a cinder block and crushing it. And he just figures he's in a nightmare. And he's like, you want to do this for me? Sure. And he ends up becoming this character. And I originally created Punchline as a villain for our Apama character, you know, and I thought that would be a really cool, you know, this, you know, heavyweight boxer named Punchline versus Apama, you know, you can't miss. So what I did was I took this idea because we were still dealing with our Apama arc. And well, let me back up just a hair. Mm-hmm. We were doing in the Apama book, this Tap Dance Killer series. Mm-hmm. It was a 2-issue sort of. Let me see. I'm getting my thoughts all crossed here. It's kind of convoluted, but I'm going to get it as clean as possible.
Okay.
All right. Apama, in issues 10 and 11, we introduced this character, Nikki St. Clair. She's a mega-talented actor who gets cast in a horror show musical as the Tap Dance Killer. But then there's a supernatural occurrence. She can't shake the role and starts trying to wipe out the mafia. So Apama gets stuck in the middle of this. What happened is I was at New York Comic Con and people kept seeing this Tap Dance Killer character. And they were like, you know, who is that? And she was getting much more attention than Apama ever did. So I decided to spin her into her own series. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, oh, this is a perfect opportunity to introduce our Punchline character. And he was a fan favorite as well. So I decided after our first arc of Tap Dance Killer, I would follow these vaudevillains, but make him sort of the lead this time around. And the other characters now, Tap Dance Killer included, are in the background as supporting cast.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So that's really cool. Now, a couple of other items I got to mention real quick. As you mentioned on the Kickstarter page, you funded in over 20, in just in 24 hours.
Yes.
So congrats on that. And as I look, as we're talking, and I think this is probably going to be up by the time this posts, you are almost 3 times your goal. If I read that right.
Yeah, we're getting there. So we're at 9,155.
Yeah. Right. That's as we're talking. And hopefully by the time this comes on Sunday, you'll be even way beyond that. This will be just a memory and something in the rearview mirror.
You never know. Yeah. I always think Kickstarter is kind of like the, we've done them before and we've had a lot of nice, success with it, but I really do kind of regard it as sort of the true virtual Comic-Con, because it's a lot of indie creators and you get the whole pitch, you get all the deals that they're throwing down, and it's fun to just kind of browse around Kickstarter if you're mm-hmm. missing Comic-Cons.
Yeah, I literally, if I have extra money, I know I'm going to have it when the time comes. I'll look around and see what's out there, and I've run into some really interesting stuff along the lines. And like I said, I saw your Apama when we were in Cleveland and we were at Comic-Con. It was a,
was I think it Space?
Yes, it was Space. We went to a Space up there.
Small Press.
Something Cleveland Expo or something like that.
I think.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't think that happened this year. We'll see what happens next year. But I ran into a lot. I'm so fascinated by these things because I live in Florida and there are pockets all across the country of people who do indie and create comics. And where you are, there's this collection of people who make comics and talk about comics and do all kinds of wonderful things. And I think that's just, I'm always fascinated by that because I always thought the only people making comics would be like in New York or Los Angeles, but there are these wonderful comics in other places. And your comics is your whole company is a perfect example of, if you think it's only in New York and Los Angeles, like I did, you're sadly mistaken because there's great stuff up there, like what you guys are doing.
I appreciate that.
It's just the greatest thing.
I don't know if we mentioned it, but yeah, I'm in Cleveland. I actually live in Akron, but our story takes place in Cleveland, grew up in Cleveland. So yeah, Northeast Ohio all my life. Mm-hmm.
There's just a whole bunch of stuff is going on. It's the greatest thing. I want to get back to Space sometime because I saw so many interesting things there. And that yours was one of the books that I came away with that was real that stuck out. And I was really fascinated by it because we already talked about Apama in the past, but yeah. We'll talk. Let's focus a little bit more on. Well, we'll talk about Tap Dance Killer and Punchline in the sense that, as I like to say, they're diverse characters.
Sure,
which is interesting.
Well, this started with Tap Dance Killer, and I am married to a black woman. We have a daughter. And it became really clear that as we were creating characters for Apama, especially villains, I just kept going white guy, white woman, Regina or whoever. You know, I didn't feel comfortable on some level making a villain a character of color. I didn't know if I was being sort of reverse discriminatory or what. But when I came up with Tap Dance Killer, I thought, well, she's sort of this anti-hero. She's a little bit, there's a lot more to her than a straight villain, which I actually do hope all of our characters are not just straight villains if they're, you know. You know, I thought, gosh, you know, if I keep going with this mentality, you know, or if the industry keeps going with this mentality, all the cool villains are going to end up being white characters, you know? So, you know, there's people who want to cosplay Harley or whatever. And I just thought this can be hopefully that kind of character. And she has resonated, you know, I'll have a big banner of her and people just come up and they, you know, and it's so interesting to me because like I worked, you know, every time you do a series, I think you learn new things. And, you know, with Apama, the undiscovered animal, which is a story of our ice cream truck driver who becomes a superhero in Cleveland by unlocking the spirit force of the most savage beast mankind has never known. Mm-hmm. That's a much tougher pitch, right? I mean, and it was, you had mentioned the film that we had done earlier called Hero Tomorrow. So I'm telling the story in reverse. And when I say, you know, sometimes our stuff, it just is so meta weird because we made a movie about a guy who has an idea for a superhero, but he can't get it published. And then he becomes his own character. And that is sort of, you know, when people are like trying to understand the relationship between Hero Tomorrow, the movie, and Apama, the Undiscovered Animal, issue one, I tell them, well, imagine if Stan Lee, instead of publishing Spider-Man, his girlfriend made him a costume of Spider-Man, and he himself ran around the neighborhood trying to be this Spider-Man with no powers. So that's really what our movie is. But then Apama is more like a Spider-Man comic. It is the book he would have created. We only did the first issue sort of as a lark for our website because we thought it would be fun to promote the movie. And that ended up going over really well. And we just found out we loved making comics and that started the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So getting back to Tap Dance Killer, you know, I just Apama was it was made to be a hard to explain idea in that movie. You know, I don't think if we were just starting to make comics, we would have come out with Apama, the Undiscovered Animal. You know, that the humor of the movie is it's so hard to explain because it's a superhero based on an animal that doesn't exist. So then with Tap Dance Killer, though, it's clean. You know, it's just a nice, you see that character, even the words. If, you know, anybody listening doesn't know who she is, I say Tap Dance Killer, there's something in your head. And it just was such an easier sell. And I find it doesn't matter if it's male, female, young, old, any ethnicity, people are really open to that character. And it was so kind of astonishing to me. And I have, you know, black women come up to me at shows and they will say, I feel seen in this character. And it just melts my heart, you know, and it's like, gosh, you know, these are the moments you feel like, wow, I'm doing what I really want to be doing and I'm supposed to be doing because I wanted this character to I felt I had a little bit of a niche and I'm not, you know, when you think of black female characters in comics, everybody goes right to like Storm and she's a tremendous character, but she's not the gal down the street. You know, she's been worshipped as a goddess, you know? So like, I wanted Nikki to be that gal down the street and you either, you know, are her friend or you want to be her friend. She's just cool, fun. So a very relatable character. And pulling on my theater background, you know, she's an actress. I pulled on all the theater stuff through my whole life. So, all right. So then now we're talking about this heavyweight boxer, you know, and you know, the great heavyweight boxers to my mind are all African-American, you know? So I just thought he's got to be a black dude and he's just going to be a badass, you know? And, the premise of him is kind of simple, mm-hmm. punchline, mm-hmm. but, I think he's in an interesting situation when we start this series, because in the Tap Dance Killer series, Punchline really wasn't challenged. They were taking on the regular mafia, and he's just wiping the floor with these people. So this is now the opportunity to bring back Apama, but in Punchline series. So Apama is going to be almost like the villain in his series, because, you know, you're telling this from the standpoint of a villain. And but Punchline's also going through something where he always wanted to do things the right way with his boxing career. You know, he wasn't into steroids. And now he's like this ultimate steroid being in a way. Mm-hmm. And that bothers him. You know, it bothers him that there are no challenges for him. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, here comes Apama, and he's going to have a hell of a challenge. And then there's a supernatural challenge coming that is something we set up in Tap Dance Killer. But if you blinked, you might have missed it. But we did set something up, and I'm really excited. So we'll be bringing in some new characters into the series. We'll be debuting a couple new characters.
I have to applaud what you're doing, because one of the things that drives me insane are people taking established costumes and stuffing a person, a diverse person, shall we say, into one of those costumes. I don't, you know, Superman was created out of the blue, and of course that was just the way that you know, the folks that created him, that was just the way he was made. But the thing of it is that there is all this potential for characters, you know, who can be different, and they don't have to be Spider-Man. They don't have to be, you know, these different people, you know, getting stuffed into existing custom. And I just think we're missing so much, you know, by doing this as certain companies like to do. But for me, when I see what you're doing, I think that's just, it's something creative. It's world building. It's as you find out, and I often see on videos on Facebook, people relate to it because you're reaching out and touching this audience that I don't think even Miles Morales touches, you know, in that sense, because, you know, and that's just my opinion. I'm just talking my stuff. Just, sure. I want to applaud what you're doing, because I think we need more of this. I think that the potential is there for all these wonderful characters, you know, that can come along and take us places we haven't been before, instead of putting, let's say, a person of color into a place we've been before. I just don't see it. So for me, I just applaud this. I think I'm so, when I see your success and I see how much people relate to it, I'm always thrilled, because I just think that we need more of this. And I hope you're introducing new characters, and I hope that some of those characters are diverse and they take off just as well.
Yeah, we're going Hispanic with a couple of them here. And, so absolutely, you know, I'm just trying to, just create new characters for everybody I can, you know. There's only so many, you know, that I'll be able to do at the rate we're going. So I want to make them count. And that's that is, I think, another point that, these comics, you know, when you're in the indie business here of making comics, the effort to get a book done is, I think it's kind of monumental at times. You know, I feel so glad when we get a book done and it's good and, you know, whatever. But like, you're going to spend a good part of several months on a story. You know, we're a pretty small team, especially on Punchline. It's just two of us. So, you just want to do everything you can to make this something different, something that, yeah, people are going to get done and be like, man, that was a damn good comic. Otherwise, why do it? You know, like, you're just going through the motions and you're beating your head against the wall. So at the end of it, and I'm the one who's paying for the production of it. So I was like, I'm not going to pay for something that I don't think is really, really good. And if it takes longer to write it or whatever, then I'll just wait, and I won't put anything out until I have something that's ready. So there we go.
Cool. That's great. I like the name is Punchline, and he's a boxer. I mean, that's just a great name for a boxer. Punch. Put the punch in the beginning there. I like that very much.
Very organic to his name. Yes.
Yeah. I like that really well. I think that was a great thing.
I appreciate that. I mentioned that because of the other punchline. I don't know. Yeah. It's just not, I don't feel like that. Well, what can I say? You know, ours came out 2 years earlier. I do want to, you know, mention that, but I just don't feel that the name is you know, ingrained as it is with ours.
Well, someday maybe what we'll do is have a punchline crossover, and we'll have all the three different punchlines all meet, and and you write one chapter, and Bill Williams write the one of the other chapters, and somehow we'll get James Tynan the fourth to write one of the chapters, and we'll do all those things. But
yeah, and a Bill Williams punchline, it was kind of interesting because their book came out darn near the same time ours did, and I looked at that and I thought, oh, you know, it was a sort of a super heroic female. And I didn't take any sort of, you know, competition thing with them. And I suspect maybe they didn't with mine. But as things started happening with the DC character, I said, well, maybe I better look at what their book actually is, you know, and, it turns out, you know, I you've read it, I assume, but there is no character named Punchline in that series. That's the name of the book. Like Walking Dead is the name of Walking Dead. So there's really no cross competition, I don't think, with the Bill Williams book. I don't suspect it would feel that way.
No, but I do love that book too.
It's a good book.
I'm a Batman guy, so I understand everybody wants to put their imprint on Batman and make something that adds to the legend, you know, and so I understand they're doing this. Harley has kind of spun off in her own thing, and now they want to do something new. But I remember my head kind of went, huh, when I saw the name. I was like, because I knew of at least the two others, and I was going like, well, that's, I guess, you know, it's a word. It's not like you're making a new Batman, you know, and DC comes flying, wait a minute, you know, you've got a word that's a real word, and, you know, it's not trademarked, I don't think, by anybody. So as far as I can tell, you have just as much right to create your punchline as anybody else does.
Well, and ours was first commercial use by, like I said, 2 years. And you know, the problem that might be a problem is they're both clown themed assassins named Punchline.
Yeah. She's got a red nose. Yep. Well, DC's going to have to start paying you in order to use that character, I think.
So. No, that would
So, well, let's talk, speaking of Punchline, let's get into the character a little more. I'm kind of curious, as you know, a boxer, did you pattern Punchline after like a real boxer, or was this a character of your imagination? How did you come up with the character and who he is?
Yeah, I sort of had this, just that idea, the simple idea of a boxer named Punch, a boxing clown named Punchline. You know, I thought that came first, and I didn't, in the back of my mind, I could see sort of big hands. You know, they looked like boxing gloves, something like that, and an afro that was blue, you know, or something, that not a funny clown afro, but sort of like a badass, rough looking afro. And then I went to town on costuming, and I probably did 15 iterations of this costume, and it, you know, nothing felt right. I mean, at one time he looked like this sort of hippie Jimi Hendrix Punchline, and so I think there was a wrestler named Tony Atlas, who I just used for a body pose. I thought he really had a good physique. And I just kept making clothes over this picture of Tony Atlas, you know, but didn't model the face after Tony Atlas. And, you know, eventually it was sort of this, checkerboard stripes, sort of all kinds of different patterns, different pattern on the sleeve, polka dots, boxing shorts, but then pants underneath those. And he just all of a sudden had his look, and I was like, man, I really like this guy, and want to do more with him.
Now, you mentioned the response of Tap Dance Killer. Has Punchline gotten any kind of response like that, the way that Tap Dance Killer did?
Definitely not. Now, not as much. And you know, this is what is interesting, because Tap Dance Killer was pulling from male and female right away. You know, so I think Punchline's back to more of a guy's kind of character. So But absolutely, I would be doing shows. I'd be talking about Tap Dance Killer, and somebody's like, "Yeah, but who's this guy?" You know, and so there we go. I just kind of go. I always sorry. One of the things I say when I'm making comics is I generally know where I'm headed. You know, with a story arc, and I sort of liken it to a cross country trip. You know, where you're driving across the United States and, but you're not taking any highways. Mm-hmm. And if you see a really cool stop along the way, you check into the hotel, you know, you go to the diner, you spend a couple of days, and that's what happens with these characters. So we're telling this Apama story. And all of a sudden I was working on a documentary, a film documentary about this theater troupe. And I had the idea to bring that into the Apama world completely off the course of the story we were telling, but it just felt like such an idea I had to tell. And Milo Miller is the co-writer on that, I should mention. And then Tap Dance Killer emerges out of that. So, you know, I know where I want all these arcs to go, but I love sort of just, yeah, stopping. And now we're going to check out Punchline. And actually he's taking that whole arc forward, the whole arc where it was supposed to go. So, and I could have done like a Tap Dance Killer. We did issues 1 through 5. We could have done Tap Dance Killer 6. But the reality is, you know, as an indie, when you're dealing with Diamond, by the time you get to your 4th or 5th issue, it's very hard to grow it with stores. They know how many copies they want to sell, and they'll order just enough. So it's difficult to get more readers to jump on. And with the way people almost tend to prefer trades anyway, mm-hmm. I just kind of like the idea that the first arc of these characters is Tap Dance Killer Volume 1, and the next one's going to be Punchline and the Vaudevillain. So, and the third one could be Hurricane Lizzie, you know, we'll follow somebody else or who knows what, you know, got to find out what stops are on this road.
Mm-hmm. Now the description gets me a little bit. He steps into the ring to fight for his very soul.
Yeah, and that was he's going to be attacked mentally by this second entity.
Okay, so more than that, we don't need to know at this point.
Yeah, it's too early. Yeah, unfortunately.
We've got to read the book, doggone it.
Tap Dance Killer 4 gives you a hint.
Okay, that's good to know, because if you go to the Kickstarter page, one of the great things about it is there's several pages that we get to see on there. And I did before I end up talking with you, I've got to say how interesting it is to take your hero and turn him into the opposite number, into a, as you say, the bad guy on some levels. I think that's so interesting. And you know what? I don't think many people would do that with their first creation. You know, not many people want to make Batman into a villain.
Well, you know, fascinating. If we're telling the story of, you know, Joker or Killer Croc and Batman's in that book, mm-hmm. you know, it's just telling the story from the villain's point of view. I mean, Punchline is the villain, but Apama, you're going to understand Punchline's, you know, what he's doing, why he's doing it. And, you know, he's going to be relatable. As much as a murderous superpowered clown can be. And so when Apama comes in, there's this conflict. So, you know, to say Apama's a straight up villain, I mean, Apama's acting as a hero, but he's foiling what Punchline's trying to do. Mm-hmm. What Punchline's trying to do isn't necessarily an evil thing at that moment. So,
But I can't see DC letting Batman be the bad guy. Although, you know, they do have the White Knight storyline where he's the Joker is kind of the good guy and Batman is the bad. But even then, they don't let him really be the bad guy. And so for me, I always fascinated with people who are confident enough in their characters to go somewhere new with that character, to let them play a different role. You know, I just think that is really something that I applaud. One of the things about indie comics is you guys get to do things that, you know, if you own a character and you have a franchise built around this character, there are only certain things you're going to be able to do with that character because they're going to stop selling underoos or something.
Right, right.
So with you, you don't have to necessarily go that route. I mean, if you wanted to, you could kill a Pama at some point. I've read, there's a book, and I always talk about this book. It was called Slaughterman's Creed, and it's a four-issue series. At the end of the second issue, the main character is killed.
Mm.
And I remember saying, wait a minute, I've got two issues to go. What's going to happen? And the writer had something very different and unique in mind, and I loved it when I got to speak to the guy. I said, oh my gosh, I couldn't believe it, you know, what you did. I love to be surprised. And so for me to see that kind of creativity and being able to move and do something, see, this is what I think one of the great things, this is a perfect example of why indie comics are in demand the way that they are now, because you do get new territory, you know, you're breaking new ground, you're doing things that are kind of fun, and we get to see things from different angles like that. So I appreciate that you had the confidence in this and the ability to tell a story that lets us see that not everybody looks at a Palma the way that a franchise owner might want them to be seen, shall we say.
Yeah, well, at the same time, this is the story I wanted to tell. You know, I wanted Punchline and Apama to throw down, you know, big time. Because often in Apama, we have him against female villains, which I think is a lot of fun, too, because, you know, he's just too much of a sort of gentleman to throw down with the ladies at fisticuffs. So he has to figure out other things, and he's just not the brightest guy. But, like, this is a rare opportunity for me to write a badass fight scene. And, you know, whether it would have taken place in Apama or in this Punchline series, he's still going to be the same character. You know, he's still trying to be his superheroic best. Apama is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's no running into Punchline and thinking this guy is anything but a nasty villain for Apama, you know. So there's plenty of reasons for them to start getting into it.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be fun. I think it's going to be one of those great stories because the thing is, you've set this up in such a way that I don't know what you're going to do. You know, if it was a Batman book, I would figure Batman's going to win.
Mm.
But in your book, I don't know. And I like that. I like not knowing which direction you're going to go. I mean, Apama could lose as far as the way that you've set it up. He could get the tar beat out of him and
right.
stuff like that, you know? And so for me, not knowing is half the fun. I mean, I want to see a story I don't know the ending to.
Oh yeah. Appreciate you know, that.
So for that, I think that's going to be great. I think other people, I think are going to enjoy that too. I just, you know, it's such an interesting concept and I love when things go places I haven't been before.
Oh, thank you.
It's such a great thing. It's such a wonderful. Now, this is Punchline number one. How many – is this going to be the only Punchline in the Vaudevillians, or do you have
– I think it'll be like a five-issue series again, and then it'll be collected.
Okay. So that'll be good. Now, let's say – now, let's go down the Kickstarter things because I always want to make sure people know that you can get things. The one that got me, I got a huge kick out of the $199 one, and I wish I could afford that. But somebody can because as I'm looking at it right now, you have
seven backers
already for the $200 thing. I mean, wow, congrats. That's amazing.
Thanks.
To get that. That is wonderful. That means there's people out there willing to put their support into it and back it.
Yeah, and that's called the draw. So all of the rewards sort of have a boxing theme. You are drawn into a story for $199, and there's one left.
Wow. Now, is this – it makes me wonder, so the art isn't completely done yet?
Well, it wouldn't be this story. It would be one of the five coming up, you know.
Gotcha. Okay, so this is a story, not the –
not this one. Yeah, it says a future story. And one is all – the art is all done. I'm still coloring about six pages.
Oh, wow. Very cool. Now, the big one, and we don't have anybody there yet, is the $500 promoter level. Five shirts of your choice. And
we got three backers at that level, sir.
Oh, do you? Oh, all right. Oh, that's what the three – that's what that means. So you don't have a limit.
No, there's no limit.
Gotcha. Okay, the other one has a limit. All right, so that's what that means. I didn't want to speak out of turn.
No worries.
That, Maybe I thought maybe you only limited to three. That would be crazy. So that makes sense.
No, right. Yeah, that one, the more the merrier. But, you know, it's like with the being drawn into a story, there's only so many I can kind of figure out over the course of so many issues, or it's going to be sort of like it'll start influencing the story too much, trying to figure out this kind of, you know.
Wow. So, wow, that, congrats on that. Boy, you're getting lots of good support. That's good to see, especially for an indie comic and stuff like that. It's wonderful to see people with, I just think that there's so much need for creativity and great storytelling out there. You know, I'm not surprised, but I'm extremely happy to see all that kind of support coming your way. And I hope to get a lot more too. I think that would be wonderful to see you.
Thanks so much. I feel very blessed. We've got a lot of people who've supported our work through the years. And really, yeah, just not being able to do comic cons is what kind of, you know, coerced the decision to go Kickstarter for a first issue, which we had never really done before. We would just kind of release through Diamond, and Diamond, in my experience, they pay for a part of our print run, and then I make up the rest on the convention scene. Mm-hmm. But without the conventions, we had to figure out something else. So here we are.
Well, that's good. Well, I'm so happy that things are going so well for you. I think that is just I know a lot of people who would love to have a share of your your success on that. And I'm just so glad that, you know, because I know I see you at conventions, and I see you talking with people and stuff and fans and stuff like that. And I always appreciate the way that you can, you know, talk with people about your stuff. That you can, you know, you've made it relatable, and therefore, when you talk with them, they can get into and understand what you're talking with them about. And it's just, you know, it's I think the future of comics lies a lot in the kind of things that you're doing, and I would like to see more of it, to be honest.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah, I just recommend for anybody out there, just get that pitch down to the bare minimum, you know, so you can get through it quick and then get into questions and things.
Yeah. Well, I was maybe let me ask you. This is keeping you busy pretty much as far as comic creation going. You're busy with Punchline right now.
Yes. Now, there was another series, Bloom, that we have three issues fully illustrated, and that was going to be released through Diamond. It was actually in solicitation in the preview guide for April when the whole industry shut down. Ah. And my rep said, you know, this is not the best time to release an issue one because, A, nobody's going to even be able to see the catalog. B, no stores are ordering anything. So we delayed it, and then that was the whole thing about waiting until the con started up, you know, just to release anything, because I'll just lose money every issue if I only use Diamond.
Right.
So I, you know, and I could have done Bloom instead of this, but I felt like I've already made the commitment to the stores. We had sort of variant covers and all that. So I feel like Bloom really does need to happen under that guise of – not guys, but when the shows are back open, I want to do Bloom the way it was intended. Mm-hmm. Although I am now thinking that maybe, you know, it might make sense to do our solicitation in Diamond at the same time we do a Kickstarter. Mm. And that way, you know, the Kickstarter represents sort of the convention income we aren't able to get. And the stores, I'll have a variant or something that's specific for the stores, different from the Kickstarter. So they've got something. I've ran that by some shop owners, and they seem pretty open to that.
Cool. Well, you know, I look forward to that. I think I got to read part of issue one, if I remember correctly, which I liked. And I think that there's all kinds of ideas in your head that I think are just bursting to get out. And I hope we get the chance to read them all, because I think there's going to be some good stuff. I wanted to wrap up with something I read on Facebook, and I was reading a story that you were telling about Jim Shooter, and I got a huge kick out of it. And I wondered if you wouldn't mind relating that story, because I thought that was a pretty interesting story that people should know about. Do you want to tell a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. I was so fortunate to be at a show. It was called Lost Nation Con, and it was, you know, within driving distance of where I live, about an hour and a half away. And the promoter of the show, the owner of the show, put me right next to Jim Shooter. So I got to hear his story sort of all day. It was amazing. And, you know, I'm doing my thing, selling my comics throughout the show. And then on the second day, the last day of the show, I said, hey, man, I'd really love to get your take on our stuff. You know, the work you did at Marvel, you know, it really shaped me. And I just kind of just want to know what you think of what we're doing. And he said, he goes, I will read it, but I got to warn you, I am going to be honest. And I said, okay. Jim Shooter has a reputation of being really tough. And I thought if the worst thing that happens here is I get chewed out by Jim Shooter, I mean, I would cross that off the bucket list, you know. Mm-hmm. All my heroes got chewed out by Jim Shooter. And I guess it was a month later, he wrote me a really nice email and he said, hey, I read Tap Dance Killer. And he said it's great. And I got a quote for you here and you can use it however you want. And he said, Tap Dance Killer is like finding water in the desert. And of course, what is on the back of our hardcover? A quote from you. Yeah.
Well, I noticed on the Kickstarter page too, under hype, that's the top.
Oh, of course. Yes. Yeah,
so that's good. And you got some other good names in there too. Jim Steranko.
Yeah.
All kinds of good people and stuff like that. So really good. So I hope you're highly encouraged by all the support and things that's going on, because you should be, because you're making great stuff. And I just think that we've got more to look forward to from you in the future. So all I can say is, man, I am applauding what you're doing, and I can't wait to see more of it as time goes on. And I hope this Kickstarter is a big success for you.
Oh, thanks so much, Wayne. And always great to catch up with you. And I miss, you know, our dinners when we're out at the shows. And, you know, we've had a lot of good times. So I just appreciate, you know, your friendship and what you're doing for all of us indies, you know, giving us a platform to let people know about our work. Thank you.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
It's always great to talk with Jonathan Thompson, creator of such good things as, gosh, my brain is just locked up on me. What good things have you made, Jonathan? Oh, wait a minute. Here, I got it. Tales from the Dead Astronaut. And what was that other good story I read of yours on your website?
The prose story?
Yeah.
The multidimensional time box?
Yeah, that's the other one.
Yeah. That's, and now Burn Residue.
Yes, that's your Kickstarter going on right now, and people always get on me because I don't say these things soon enough in the interview, but this project will fund when it reaches its goal no later than Saturday, November 28th at 12 a.m.
It is midnight on Black Friday. It was originally supposed to be, the layout would have been Thanksgiving, but I figured let's go for the bonus promotion of Black Friday.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And that kind of fits with the story in some levels, I think.
Exactly.
You know, so we go with that. Now, you've got a goal of $5,000, and as we're recording this a little early, you're about halfway there, and I'm hoping by the time this posts, maybe you'll be into stretch goals and good things like that.
Yeah, that would be nice, wouldn't it?
That would be a wonderful thing to see. Now, I'm going to read real quickly. This is a 3-issue miniseries. It's a crime story about the cost of revenge on the human soul, which is right up your alley. You do these kinds of supernatural or extra normal kind of things really well. So Why don't you talk a little bit about what this is about? Just give us a little more story about it.
So Burn Residue is about Willie Boyd. He is a mild-mannered gas station attendant who is content with his life of being not paid attention to. And
anonymity, I think it is.
Anonymity. He has third-degree burns all over his body. And one night, a car pulls in, driven by one of the men who set him on fire years ago.
Oh, wow. Okay, that is wild doings. I didn't realize. See, on the page that you have, there are several pages from the story, and I didn't realize that what was going on. Oh, man. Woof. That is a wild, wild story. And I always like to ask, where did the story come from?
You know, this is fun because after doing Tales from the Dead Astronaut, I wanted to do something different, but still in what I enjoy. And I love crime comics. You know, I always joke that the most informative comic of my youth was a 100 Bullets. And that probably says all the wrong things about me. You know, as a high schooler reading 100 Bullets, yeah, that was me. During the pandemic, I wanted to support my local comic shop more, especially when Diamond shut down. So I started buying the Criminal graphic novel trades, and I would just like devoured them. So that was one part of it. So I knew, I was like, this is something I want to do, a crime story, and I want to expand beyond what I did with Tales from the Dead Astronaut, which was kind of getting my feet wet in comics, which was doing these short stories to build up how I view the medium and building my own understanding of the medium through my own writing. I was ready to like make the plunge and do something that was a little more larger in scope.
This is different, I have to say.
But you know, it is similar in a lot of ways. You know, I'm always going to feel me in everything. I think Tales from the Dead Astronaut and sci-fi was the more like wild psychedelia side of myself, and then this was the dark noir film, you know, just what comics can do is always part of it, and then just like character, and that was a big part. But what happened is I saw Rossano Pagioni's art and I reached out to him. I said, I want to work with you. He has such like a rough style, and he does crime books. So I was like, okay, this will be something. I pitched him a bunch of ideas that he wasn't really that enthusiastic with. And then I thought of an idea for this character who was just a gas station attendant with third-degree burns on his body. I said, Rossano, why don't you draw this up and see what we could do? And he gave me that original character design, which is at the front of the Kickstarter. And once I saw that, I knew we had something. So I was like, okay, who is this character? Where does he come from? And let's build a world around this.
Does he do the lettering, or does that you that does that?
I did the lettering. I'm a complete novice with lettering, which I think was good in a way because I didn't have set rules for myself, and I kind of felt it on the page and almost, you know, tried to contribute to the tone of the story as well when I did it.
Because the text is a little bumpy, is the way I look at it.
Yeah, I like the font that I found.
Mm-hmm. It's wild. I mean, it was like recently on DC, they had the Joker, and they made, when the Joker speaks, his font is a different font. The typeface is different. Mm-hmm. And it's that way with this. I get a sense that when he speaks, it's, if we heard it, or even when he thinks, it's something different. Even though the guy who shows up at the gas station, his text is also in that way, but he's got a white word balloon around it.
Well, what I say about the whole story is being told after the fact. So not everything you're seeing is the truth. I don't think Willie is a reliable narrator. Issue 2 digs into that more. You can read it many ways, issue 2, but I believe that Willie's an unreliable narrator, and I wanted to add that and make that part of the texture of the book. And especially, like, I didn't put caption boxes around the narration. mainly because I thought the art was so like dark and beautiful. I was like, why am I going to block it out any more than it needs to be?
Oh, that drives me nuts when I see that on in comics, when there's this beautiful art and there's these word balloons covering up all the gorgeous stuff.
I know. I know.
Oh, it drives me crazy when I see that. So I do video reviews for somebody. And when I do, I'm always really critical of the lettering because I, just for that reason, I think that people, they worry about making the lettering more pronounced than the art. And that just makes me go nuts because this is a visual medium. You know, we need to see things. And so I applaud what you're doing. I think that was a smart move. I think it really works.
Yeah. Thanks.
It adds also a little bit of, I don't know how to put it exactly. A little mystic quality to it that it's not the way that normal comics go. And I love something that takes a chance and goes a different route. So visually, this is really interesting to me. I really like that.
Yeah, I thanks. Because, you know, that was one thing where I started off just doing it to, you know, as I got pages in, I wanted to see how it was clicking, you know, just in general. Because when I worked with George on Tales from the Dead Astronaut, he did the lettering and he hand drew the caption boxes and the bubbles and then added the text in, you know, in digitally afterwards. But this was a situation where Rossano is Italian and we can communicate well, but still his English is limited too. So I couldn't have expected him to put together all the lettering, even though this book is being released in Italy as well, which is pretty cool because Rossano has his own publishing house in Italy.
Oh.
So that was like one of the first deals we made together was to put it out there too. So that's super exciting personally for me. But, you know, I'll be officially a published author in Italy before I am in America, but I suppose that's a different story. But, you know, I did the lettering because I wanted to see how it was working because it was a big movement for me to go from those short tales to a longer piece. And yeah, it just, his art is so perfectly beautiful for this. And just once I started seeing it to come together, I was like, I liked everything that was going on. And I stuck with it.
See, I want to get into the art because I want to talk a little bit about what's on the Kickstarter. I consider to be – it doesn't spoil things if I refer to the Kickstarter because anybody can look
at it. No. Yeah, exactly.
The one thing you didn't – that at least I didn't hear you mention was the fact that Willie Boyd was a one-time high-stakes gambler.
Yes, and we see that. You know, what's great is that you, by the end of issue one, you fully understand who he is. And it starts off with that moody setup, the darkness of this guy. And you get to see him in his the height of his life when he would go on the casino ships and win every hand he threw down until he played a hand against a Yakuza hitman that didn't end up well for him.
Apparently not. But now I want to get into the art because, see, that there's so many interesting elements to this. I often talk with people about smaller towns and isolated settings and stuff like that. Really, anything can happen in those settings. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting to me that Willie, let's just say if Willie was in a city setting or something, he might draw some attention the way that he looks.
Yeah.
Could we say that?
Is that 100%. 100%.
Because he's got the way that he's drawn. If you look at the Kickstarter page, you'll see that he's got, let's just say that the fire or whatever it was that burned him really did a number on his appearance and stuff like that. The interesting thing about this to me, and I don't know if the original art that I see of him is a little different from the art that I see in the story, and that there are hairs that are sort of scattered across his head, and it gives him an unkempt kind of feel. We first see him in the shadows, which I think is a great way to introduce him, and then suddenly we see his face, and he's got a Band-Aid on his head and stuff like that, and let's just say that I don't care where you bump into him, you would be a little surprised.
Yes,
I would say.
that was like a thing for me and Rosanna was, you know, there's an important distinction between the life Willie lives now and the life he lived. So I said he should look like almost like James Bond when we see him in the past, when he's playing cards and he's just like all bravado. And then, you know, Rosanna draws him so beautifully as like a horrific monster. Mm.
It's interesting that he actually got hired to do this. I mean, if he wasn't in the middle of nowhere, I mean, that would be, I don't know if you're going to tell that story, but it'd be interesting to know how he got hired to do this.
I don't know.
I don't know if you're going to tell that, but it's something I would like to hear anyway.
That's interesting.
That's
good notes, because I think we'll come back to this character when we're all done.
Oh, good. Oh, good. So in other words, we might not get that the first time, but we might have another time to do that. Now, I'm so interested in, you know, the setting is, as I said, the isolated settings to me always appeal to me, because I said, like, anything goes. And this guy is sitting there, and it seems to be the middle of the night is when the things start out, shall we say. And I'm always fascinated that he's up that time of night. And, you know, of course, that's a good time for him, because he probably is not going to see a lot of people.
Yeah, he's the night shift guy.
Yeah, that is so something. Of course, that's why it's called burn residue, is that he is the burn residue, basically, of all this. And I really like the fact that in the beginning, he actually goes out and pumps the gas for somebody. And that's, I think, what he does for the second guy, for the guy that comes up. He's going out there to pump the gas, which, again, that's something we don't see much these days. I mean, you do that. It's a self-serve almost everywhere. And yet here he is doing something. See, that's an interesting thing for somebody who has that appearance to actually have to go out and interact with customers like that. I would think that an organization would prefer that he stayed inside and let the other people pump their gas. So
well, I think
there's
we're
another
far enough into the future. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a puzzle to me. See, all these things I get when I see this stuff, I get questions, and those are some of the questions I real got, you know, and I just like to know how that happens. How in the world do they decide he needs to go out and pump the gas? That's something that I would find appealing.
I think you just gave me all the ideas I need for a one shot later on.
Okay. I can't help, but I this is one of the reasons I'm so happy I do a podcast, is because I get all these questions and I am just dying to find out the answer to these things. Now, of course, another thing that we find out, we all these different pages, when we get to page 3, there's an interesting revelation going on in there. It says in the back seat of the car is a woman gagged and bound. And you know, that's an interesting question. Now, this guy, of course, now that I know a little bit more about him, I'm a little less surprised as to why that is. So I'm fascinated about that. And so I the one thing that happens in the pages that we see is the guy driving the car wants to go for what he calls a real pump. And he tells him there's a real pump in the back. And of course, right away I say, uh-oh, I'm not sure this guy should really go to the back.
So
you know, like that
kind of thing that I was an original concept that took a little bit of time to fully explain to Rosano was that I like to imagine this story taking place. Well, the story does take place like 10 years in the future. So every car is an electric car. So in that first scene, he's pumping, he's recharging cars. That's why it goes from low charge to full charge. Yes. So the real pump is that at the reason you'll learn is that Lanny, the driver of the Mustang that pulls up, that's not very common for people to be driving in this time. So he has to drive around with many cans of gasoline. So he's going somewhere and he needs one of the few real pumps that have petrol around back.
Oh, gotcha. Mm-hmm. Oh, and of course there's a woman in the back seat. Oh.
Yes, she's going somewhere.
Okay. And of course, oh gosh, when it has special meaning for Willie, of course. So
even more when you find out later on how all of those things came into play in his past.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Oh, gosh. Oh, man. Oh man, this is going to be this. That's really interesting.
It's a character study. And that's what this first issue really is. It's about Willie making that decision to. Lanny comes in, and he's got the woman in the back, and Willie sees an opportunity to get revenge or be a hero and save someone. And he hops on his motorcycle and he chases after. And as he chases after, he thinks about the life that he used to live and what happened to him. So that by the time everything collides by the end of the issue, you know, you feel all of the emotion that Willie has and everything that's driven him to this point until you get to the big finale of issue one, which personally disturbed me to write.
Okay.
And then disturbed me to see. And because it disturbed me, I knew I was going in the right direction.
Okay. See, that's, you know, often people say they want to write the stories they want to read. Mm-hmm. And I guess in a case that's kind of what you were doing here. You were making things, you're going a direction that you would like to see a story go. And that's not necessarily what the rest of us want to see.
Not even what I want. You know, I think there's that old adage of just like characters taking over for their own story and writing themselves and you thinking it's going to, like, I did think it was going to go a different way until I got to those final pages. And I said, well, this has to be the way it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And that also, you know, the dread that I even felt as a writer, you know, sometimes even gave me pause to send out to people. You know, because we've had a few reviews, which I thought was important. And, you know, it does fill me with my own dread to be like, okay, well, this is what it is. And this is how horrific it gets. But everything about that completely informed how I wrote issue two. So I'll say anybody who backs it and they get to that last page of issue one and they feel just wrong and sick to their stomach, you should feel that way. I will say Willie is not a hero. And issue two will inform you even more. And the whole piece, I just think, flows so beautifully into that. Like, it truly is about the cost of revenge on the human soul.
So it's less about his appearance than it is about who he is inside.
Yeah. You know, burn residue is not just, it's about everything that has happened since Willie was first lit on fire and how that affects everything.
It's interesting because I was thinking you were largely referring to the physical aspect, but sounds like, yeah, you're dealing more with the internal, the who he is inside.
Yeah, it's a psychological horror story is the way I really like it came to me in the end.
That's so interesting because I was a little distracted by the fact that he looked that way. And maybe that's part of the plan here is to get
That's almost the hook, right?
Yeah.
I think that's also great for me as a reader when I think I'm getting one thing and then by the end I'm just like, oh, that's not what this was. This was something completely different. You know, I hope that each issue, you know, we can talk about this later, but in the Kickstarter, I have two different options as to way you can consume Burn Residue. And one is a single issue monthly version where like each month you'll get the issue one and then issue two and then issue three. And I think that's really fun for people because then they could have that like just sitting with it. But then we're going to have a graphic novel option also where you could just sit down and read it all together as one piece. So I like offering both of those experiences.
Because the one that I signed up for, and I was glad to sign up for it, was the digital version. And I always have to tell people I'm running out of room to keep physical copies.
Well, so I'll say you're probably going to upgrade to the graphic novel version because we have Jacob Phillips doing the cover for that, and he's going to be getting that to us later next week. We'll probably debut it midway through, and I'm sure, like, I am already prepared to be blown away by that, and I know how much you like having something beautiful sitting on your shelf, even if it's
horrific. That's all right. Well, you
know how I am with covers.
Yes. You talked me into it. I just upgraded to that while we were talking. So
necessary. I'm telling you, once people, it's going to take a little time for him to do it, because obviously he's doing his own work with that Texas blood. But when I was able to get him on board, I knew that I was like, oh, this is going to put us over, because I know he's just going to create something horrifically beautiful to display the whole shit, you know, the whole story.
Hmm. That's really fascinating, because your stories always get me. I, as I always like to say, I love to be surprised, and I Thanks. Never know. I mean, even in your setup, I'm surprised by a lot of the elements involved in it. So where you're even going, I mean, I don't have a clue, and I'm just so fascinated by that. I love to know. I love to find these things out. When I don't know, then I really want to know. So
yeah,
that's the thing.
Yeah.
The one drawing that I really wanted to talk a little bit about, though, was the one where he's got a knife and he's standing in front of the recharge, and he's got an ace of hearts, interestingly enough, on the knife. What were you accomplishing with that? That's an interesting way to display.
So we've been very lucky with the people that have, like, the professionals that have really reacted well to what I've sent in. You know, like I said, Jacob became involved. The writer of that Texas Blood, Chris Condon, he's been a great, like, just a nice little friendship has developed between the two of us. You know, I did an interview with him that was for Backers Only that I released yesterday, which was great. You know, it was really cool to give people something. But this piece is done by David Lapham, the creator of Stray Bullets. So I reached out to him to see if he would do something. And so he read that first issue. He called it Sick and Twisted, which is a high compliment from him. And he put this piece together for me. And I'm going to, part of the Kickstarter, I'm going to raffle this off to every tier gets, like, it's in the Kickstarter. Each tier gets like a certain number of raffle tickets based on what you've pledged. And at the end, I'm going to raffle it off, and the winner gets this beautiful piece.
Well, good. Good. That's what I want to. I'm glad to hear that, because quality things, I think, deserve support. And I think your stuff, like I said, surprises me every time. I love to be shocked, and I love to be surprised. And with Burn Residue, I don't know what you're going to do. And I love that. I think that's the kind of storytelling that keeps me coming back for more. So I think that's great. That's good. Such good stuff. Well, all I can tell you is, Jonathan, I hope by the time this is up, the stretch goals are, if you haven't reached them by then, they're on the horizon, and we'll get some good things to happen. And again, it's Burn Residue, a 3-issue miniseries, a crime story about a cost of revenge on the human soul. Which, and knowing the story, this is going to be wild. I just can't wait to see it. This project will fund when it reaches its goal no later than Saturday, November 28th at 12 a.m.
It is midnight on Black Friday.
Well, I can tell, Jonathan, you're doing a wonderful job, and I'm shocked by the stuff that you do, and I can't wait to see the other stuff. So just keep doing it, and I think your audience and your fan base is just going to keep growing, and it's going to be wonderful, wonderful stuff for those of us who luckily enough jump on board. So just keep that good stuff coming.
What if you hunted monsters for a living? What if it was just a job and not some grand calling? And what if that job, like so many other jobs, absolutely sucked? Monster Hunter for Hire is an anthology about a man who has no illusions about being the hero. What seems both horrifying and exciting to us is just Tuesday for him.
It's always great to talk to Matt Shore, the creator of such wonderful things as Moby Dick. What was I forget the subtitle off the top of my head there. What was that, Matt?
It's Moby Dick, Back from the Deep.
Yes, the zombie Moby Dick. That still amazes me. I just think that's such an unexpected concept. I love that so much. So now you've got a new Kickstarter going on. Let's talk about Monster Hunter for Hire. Why don't you tell us about that? We'll dive right in and get the Kickstarter stuff going, because that's always the most important part.
All right, sure. Monster Hunter for Hire. This is a anthology comic. It's a collection of 4 different stories, 32 pages. And it's a story of a guy named Tommy who is this freelance monster hunter. That's his job. And for him, it's not any kind of, you know, grand calling or anything. It's just work, and it sucks. He hates everything about this job. It's miserable. It's you're always working at night. Everything's trying to kill you. It's just a horrible experience. But the problem is he doesn't know how to do anything else. So this collection of, we got four different stories in this anthology comic. And in each one, Tommy goes on some mission hunting down some kind of specific monster, like a werewolf or a vampire. And it never works out the way that it should. It always blows up in his face, or in some cases bites him in the butt. So yeah, really? Tommy's a real down on his life kind of guy. I've described him to people as a cross between Ash from Evil Dead and Al Bundy from Married with Children.
Oh, goodness. That's an interesting combination. I got to ask, of course, where did this concept come from? I mean, so you come up with inventive stuff like the zombie Moby Dick. I thought that's unusual, too. And so I expect interesting and unusual stuff from you. Where did this come from?
You know, the dark recesses of my mind, I guess. I don't know. Honestly, all kidding aside, a lot of the stuff that I end up sort of playing with, it is just sort of weird. Like, for instance, one of my favorite films that I ever saw to this day, it was called Bubba Hotep. I don't know how many people know about this film, but it stars, speaking of Ash from Evil Dead, it stars Bruce Campbell, and he is this like 70-plus-year-old Elvis, and the premise is that Elvis never really died. He went off and was forgotten in this old folks' home, and he's wasting away until it gets besieged by a mummy wearing cowboy boots. And that's our story. And it's this bizarre concept that really manages to be both hilarious and touching. And I don't know, I think that just inspired the stories that I like to tell. I like monster stories. I like horror stories, but I always do something with, I guess I just want to do something a little bit different, not just the typical, slasher film tropes or the damsel in distress tropes. It's just some little, sometimes I'll play with those and do something. I try to do something unpredictable with them.
Mm-hmm. Cause that's interesting. Cause the description on the Kickstarter page says a horror anthology comic where each tale has a dark and amusing twist. Now yes. That's a challenge. Of course, you've set a challenge for yourself that each story is going to have to do those things. And of course you wouldn't say such a thing unless you had such good things in mind already.
Correct. The artwork is actually already finished. We've already collected all of that from the artists. So that's one nice thing, you know, as far as risks and challenges, don't have any there. I've got the art. All I got to do is collect the funds and put it in print. And I've been able to take a little bit of pride in being somebody who is able to get his rewards out pretty quickly. With the mail the way it is these days, that might be a little challenging, but so far I've had a pretty good track record with that.
But, that's good.
But getting to where you talk about the twist, that's another thing. Like, I grew up loving Tales from the Crypt, both the comics and the TV show. And that's what every single story was. And like in the third act, there's always some kind of like unexpected twist in the story. Sometimes it's just hilarious and other times it's just really dark, but it always happens. So that's what I have with this. Like, you know, the story starts out one way and then like I try to, right there at the end, this big monkey wrench, like not working out the way Tommy or the reader expects.
Cool. Because honestly, having read things as long as I have and read as many as I have, something that can surprise me is always going to get my attention. Because
I hope I succeed in this.
Oh, well, Zombie Moby Dick got my attention. I didn't expect that. So I always like something that is a little different. And I always tell the tale of this guy from the UK who watched a documentary. It was on slaughtering pigs. And he came away with this idea for a comic called Slaughterman's Creed. And I said to him, I don't know if I could watch a documentary about that and come away with a comic book concept. That's the creative mind for you. It's just, you see something, you go, hey, that would make a great comic. And I watch it and I go, ooh.
Yeah. Inspiration comes from weird places and unexpected places a lot of times.
which is cool. I mean, you know, that's the great thing about it. Now, this is a little different from the stuff that you guys have, that you've done in the past. This is a little different from the other books of yours, like the Moby Dick book, in the sense that this is an anthology. And it's interesting to me that Kickstarter seems to really support anthology books. And I guess in some ways you get different artists and sometimes different writers and everything, and you get their fans as well as your fans involved, and that kind of helps things to happen. Why an anthology book? I'm just kind of curious, did you have more than one story you wanted to tell rather than one longer story? How did you decide on an anthology?
Sure. Well, one reason is I do love anthologies. Like I said, Tales from the Crypt, that, you know, it's not a serialized adventure. It's just a bunch of ghost stories that the Crypt Keeper tells us. I also read a lot of like the initial Ninja Turtles comics, or a lot of anthology, just adventures in there. They weren't really all connected. And I especially liked collections where it's just a collection of short stories, be they comics or, you know, novels or anything, like just a collection of ghost stories or spooky tales. I don't know. I grew up on those. I loved those. And so I had this particular hero, if I can call him that, Tommy, started with one adventure that I did where he is hunting down this vampire. And I wrote that one, and we even got the artwork for it from another project that just, you know, never came together. But I held on to it just like I always do. Any kind of story or idea I have that I start on, if I don't finish it, I just save it and set it aside, thinking, okay, maybe I'll come back to it. And that's what happened with this. Like, I went back and reviewed that first story, and then I just had ideas for other ones where a similar thing happened, where, like with that vampire story, he's hunting a vampire, but it's not so simple as he just goes, he kills the vampire and everything is good. Things don't work out. And so I took that idea with like other monsters. Like there's a werewolf story in here that doesn't go as planned. There's a story about a mummy. And then moving away from the universal monsters, it's just something a bit more folklore. There's a story where he's hunting down a giant in the mountains. Hmm. And again, every time things don't work out the way he expects.
Okay, well, that's good in a way. I mean, it sounds like most of the jobs I had, I tried to do something and it never quite went the way that I wanted it to. So that's kind of an interesting way to do that. So is Tommy based on anybody in particular? I mean, you mentioned the combination of the two different characters, but oftentimes characters are also based on somebody that you know, or you sometimes even. Is Tommy based on somebody in real life, or is he your imagination combining these two characters?
I'm going to say he's a combination of three things. He, like I said earlier, his character, he's really a combination of Ash, where he, you know, he can kick ass if he needs to, but he's also just utterly miserable. And speaking of miserable, you have Al Bundy, who is from Married with Children, who's just constantly down on life all the time. Like that famous picture of Al Bundy with this sad look on his face in front of a scoreboard. And on one side, it says Al Bundy 0, life 1. That's his life. So those two kind of define Tommy. And then the name Tommy, I'm going to call it an homage. I don't want to say I stole it. It's an homage to Friday the 13th, because I loved that series so much. Tommy Jarvis, the one guy who was always able to stop Jason. When I was thinking of who my hero, what I wanted to name him, Tommy just made sense to me.
Okay, well, that's cool. Those things kind of work all together to make it one. Now, you were mentioning that you did this one story a while back. How old or how long ago did you make that story happen before this thing all, the rest of the story started to happen?
The oldest one in here, the vampire story, is probably about at least 2 years old, maybe older. I've kind of lost track over the years. And then the other ones, I mean, some of them are about a year old too, because that's the thing about being an indie creator. You do stuff as you find the time or the funds, or, you know, just as the resources come. It's not like working for a major comic publisher like DC or Marvel, where just the funds are there. That's the job and you do it. I'm not complaining about this. This is the way life works. So in this case, and that's another reason why whenever I have ideas, I hang on to them, because maybe I can't do them right then, when there's a possibility later on down the road, I will. And that's what happened with Monster Hunter for Hire. I kept slowly collecting the artwork for these stories as the funding came available. And then once I had them, I realized, okay, I've actually got my full comic now. I can put this thing together and put together this anthology that I've been kind of dreaming about for a little while now. And so here we are. We're launching a Kickstarter. We're hoping to get this thing out just like Moby Dick.
Okay, right now, some people get on me because I never get to the vital statistics as quickly as they would like. We're talking just as the thing has launched the same day, but it's going to has to be reach its goal by Friday, December 4 at 1:43 p.m. And you've got a very modest goal, I mean, as far as this stuff goes. I'm hoping you've got good stretch goals in mind because, you know, the first day you've got about at least a quarter of it done. I mean, I can say the goal is $500. I mean, you look at the thing, you'll see that. And it's just kind of fascinating to me. Is it because you've already invested the money in the artist, in the art and stuff like that, that the goal is so modest?
Yes, that's a big reason why. And that's a habit strategy. I don't know what else to call it. That I started with Moby Dick, because that one is still first and foremost a web comic. So when the time comes to put it in print, I already have all of my pages and I've already paid for them all. So I'm then able to, all I need to worry about is the funding to get it printed. And it's the same thing here. I have the artwork, everything is ready to go. So the only funding I need to get it out, I always set the number I set is 100. So the funding that I need to print 100 copies of this would be $500. And as far as stretch goals, I do have a few in mind if and when we reach that point that I can start announcing.
Cool. So as far as you were saying that maybe it was before we started recording that you've got this stuff all together and you can get these things printed pretty quickly after the project is completed, right?
Yeah, really. As soon as the only thing that is not done at this point, one of the rewards we're offering is the chance to have your name on the cover. And our plan for that is we're going to have our hero standing in a cemetery and everybody's names, and there is a limited number, but the people who get that particular reward will get their names on a headstone in that cemetery.
Mm. Oh, cool. Well, that's different. I like that. It's something unique. Now, you were mentioning about the fact that there's the dark and amusing twists. I'm going to be fascinated because, you know, especially we just got through Halloween and I've seen a lot of different things going on with these. Are you, I can't imagine you're doing this. I can't imagine you're going down the traditional lanes with the vampires and the werewolves and the zombies and stuff like that. You've got to have, like you're saying, there's got to be something unique and different going on with these. Otherwise you wouldn't tell that story. Did you go into these stories doing that, knowing that you had that you've seen these kinds of monsters and you had something unusual you want to do with them? Or did you, once you start writing, you got the vampire one then, and then you started to move on to the other ones. And then as you got into the story, the twist and the unusual approach, appeared to you. How did that happen?
Well, it really, again, comes back to that vampire story. I was putting it together for another project where what they wanted, they said, we just want horror stories that are just different. They don't fit anywhere else. And so give us something that's just different. So when I took, that was my only guideline. So when I scripted the story out, what I wanted to play with at the time, the Twilight series was really popular. So, and not just Twilight, you have Vampire Diaries and it's a little more gritty. You've got True Blood, but this where vampires are being kind of romanticized. So that's what I wanted to play with that story. Like, okay, we're kind of romanticizing vampires now. So I've got this hero who hunts them down for a living. What's his perspective on this going to be? And then like, what, how's this going to resolve itself by the end of the story? And, it just went from there, just using that same sort of mentality with other stories as well, like with the werewolf, like, okay, how can we turn this around to something a little bit beyond what we would expect? And same way with like the mummy and the giant story as well. Just, you know, what can we do to play with the traditional idea that we would have for this and really kind of twist it around in an unexpected way.
Mm-hmm. See, I dare not ask what it is because I want to read the story. I don't want to be spoiled. I want to read this stuff because, like I said, the Moby Dick, it surprised me. I read the first thing, and I didn't understand what you meant back from the deep, what that was all about. And so when I got to where I found in, I didn't read the description either. I read the story. And when I got to the place where I discovered that, he was one of the undead, I was shocked. I have to admit, I was like, whoa, I did not expect that. And I kind of figured I'm going to get those same kind of surprises in these stories.
I hope so. That's the goal.
Yeah, because honestly, I have read many vampire stories, and I'm looking forward to something I haven't read before, to be honest. I mean, you're right. See, I could never get into the Twilight stuff. I just couldn't do it. And so for me, and I do like the show Supernatural, and so I watch that, and they sometimes will come up with stuff. I can't say they're always unique, but they do something a little different or do a little, maybe a different focus on it or something like that. But I kind of have higher expectations for yours. I think yours is going to, I'm going to really enjoy reading those. I think those are going to be great fun.
Well, I hope so. That is the goal.
Now, I notice, are all the stories in black and white?
Yes, they are. I stick with black and white with horror because I think it just works better with horror stories, because I'm a huge fan of that film noir style anyway, like Frank Miller, the way he drew Sin City, using a lot of black and high contrast stuff. I love doing that. Like one of these stories, it was the giant story. Normally, I haven't had to give a whole lot of direction to the artists. I like to let them tell the story as they see it and interpret it. But his was the only time I gave any real direction. He asked me, like, is there anything I should do differently? And I said, can we put in more black? Let's get more shadow in there and really make it stark and dark. And it's the sort of thing, and things like that, I think you can only do with horror comics. Like if you're drawing like a superhero comic per se, it has to be flashy and bright and almost photorealistic. That's the visual you want, because that makes this real wow factor. But with horror, you can tell stories that are almost otherworldly and surreal, and you can draw them in a way that doesn't always make sense. And that's okay with horror. You're allowed to experiment like that. Horror audiences sometimes even expect that. And I don't know, it allows artists to play around a lot more. And So long way back around to the black and white thing. I love black and white with horror comics because I just think it looks better. I think it looks creepier and spookier.
Well, it's interesting because I wrote a column recently about black and white versus color. And I use it as an example. Mike Mignola did a Batman statue. And they actually did it a version in color and one in black and white. And it's the reaction that I got from looking at them is interesting. The color, you're right. Even though, you know, Mignola draws with those kind of sloped shoulder kind of setup. When I looked at the color one, I got a happier feel from it. When I looked at the black and white one, you know, of course, it was a lot darker. I kind of expected him to be doing darker things than the guy that was in color. So you're right in that sense. I think that the black and white, especially in horror, is a wonderful thing. It also, you can hide things in the shadows a lot better when you've got just black and white to go. And you can make things, our imagination has to engage, because real life is not black and white, but color. And when we look at these kinds of things, our brains kind of supply the gray tones probably. And honestly, that if I was ever in a situation like that, I would be terrified pretty much if I was in a real black and white, in a world that was black and white. So I'm glad that you're doing that, because I think it adds that layer to it that makes it so much more fun to read.
Yeah, and we don't do this particular thing so much in this comic, but black and white and like use of darkness to cover things up, like an image where all you see are like just a little bit of a creature, like you might see its eyes and its teeth and maybe a claw or something coming out of the shadow, and then everything else is solid black. I find that image far more terrifying than just a picture of this a beautiful drawing of this monster with all of its, you know, features accentuated in some way. Like the less you see a lot of times with monsters and creatures, the better.
Yeah, less is more in a case like that. Yeah. Now, you've got four different artists. The first artist we know from the artist who did Moby Dick back from the deep is the one that did he do the vampire one?
He, Joe Bilicic, did the mummy story for me.
The mummy story. Okay, that's interesting. That'll be interesting. Part of me wants to ask a lot more questions and find out more about the story. But in a short story, sometimes knowing too much before you get to it kind of dulls it. So I don't want to necessarily do that. But
I'll reveal just very, very little bit. Like in Joe's case, with this particular one, the story takes place in a museum. And so Joe's artwork lends itself to that really well, because he, of all the ones I have in here, I think he is the most film noir feeling artist that I've got. And so with like the darkness and the shadows of the halls at night, his artwork for that is just spectacular. And then after Joe is Alex Garcia from Mexico City. He's done independent comics like his best known one might be Guardians, or a friend of mine named Todd Black. But his artwork is really kind of flamboyant, boisterous, big. So naturally, I got him to draw my story about a giant. He was a perfect fit for that.
Okay.
The vampire story, that was Tim Bauer. And his artwork was used most recently in another collection of ghost stories called Dark Side of Seoul, as in Seoul, South Korea. So it's got that same kind of style of trying to think of a good way to describe, like, vampire, sleek, almost sexy look to it. And last but most certainly not least, Alex Green, that's from Great Britain. And her artwork feels like it was taken right out of a Universal monster movie. Like the first time I saw her panels, where like I saw like the woods of while they're out hunting this werewolf. I mean, it was just a perfect visual. I loved it so much. So I've been real lucky to get a good team of artists to work with me on this.
And now, how did you discover those people? I mean, Joe, obviously you knew before because Moby Dick. Did he do this story after Moby Dick or during Moby Dick? How did he – when did that come in his schedule?
Midway between, because he's still working on Moby Dick for me. And
okay.
He actually put that one together for me in the early days of the pandemic. When I sort of put Moby Dick on hold at the time – because I thought, I don't know if I need to do a Kickstarter because I don't know how active people are going to be on it. And then come to find out, well, people are sitting at home. What else are they going to do?
Right, right.
So apparently it was a great time to get on Kickstarter. But anyway.
Kickstarter actually was looking for people to do projects when the pandemic hit.
Yeah, it seems that way.
It really was, because one person I know who works with them in some level, he was saying that they were literally going around begging people to do Kickstarter projects.
Well, I wrestled with it for a while because I just thought, and maybe I was just overthinking it, but I just thought, you know, people are getting sick. People are out there dying. People are losing their jobs. Do I have any business getting up here and asking them for money for my little comic book? But ultimately, I think I talked to some other people that were doing it, and they told me, like, you know, it's actually doing okay. People are still pretty active on Kickstarter. So I gave it a shot and had, at the time, that was my most successful one yet. So if fingers crossed that maybe we can kind of duplicate that here, that'd be fantastic.
Well, it'd be great, because one of the things we discovered is without conventions, there are people who have money that they would normally have spent at conventions. And so now what they're doing is looking for other avenues to meet those comic needs. And I think Kickstarter is one of the things that's helping with that. I'm kind of interested as to how you came across the artists. I mean, was there some avenue that you did it? I mean, online, how did you find them?
Of course, Joe, I already knew. And when I started doing these, I definitely had to bring Joe back. Tim Bauer, who did the vampire one all those years back, I got to know through that other project. Like, he and I were introduced to one another through email, and I was able to stay in touch with him to make sure that we could bring this story back. Alex Garcia, who did the giant story, I came in contact with him through our mutual friend, another creator out there named Todd Black, who Alex had worked for. So they, or Todd got us in connection with each other, and that worked out really well. And the last one was Alex Green, and just got on artist, what am I looking for here? Message boards, and put the word out looking for an artist there. And she jumped aboard, and her style just, it worked. And she said she was looking to expand her horizons and do something in horror, something kind of new. And I said, okay, I've got something for you. And here we are.
Because it's an interesting divergence. I mean, you got one from Mexico City and one from the UK. I guess the one guy is Joe local to you? I'm trying to remember.
He's not local to me, but he is from America. He's from Florida. Okay. And the, you know, diversity and how far across the globe, that was a happy accident. I'm thrilled to have a diverse team. That's really cool, I think. But one thing I was very conscious of when I started looking for people, I wanted the artwork for each story to be very noticeably different. I didn't want them to all look like they were drawn by the same person. I wanted each story to have artwork that was complementary of that story. Like I said earlier, Joe's really kind of creepy film noir style worked really well with the mummy story, which all takes place in this museum. So you have dark hallways and shadows, and it's real creepy and claustrophobic that way. And meanwhile, with Alex, who's done this, you know, big, you know, gigantic stories with superheroes, he was a natural pick for a story about a, you know, this giant in the mountains. So everything is big and enormous in that story. And, Tim Bauer, his style was like sleek and sexy. And of course, Alex Green is almost rather photorealistic, like something pulled out of an old black and white movie. I think I'm rehashing things here, but the point was, I just wanted four very different styles for four very different stories.
Cool. Because, you know, every monster is, I always find it odd when the monsters kind of work together. I always feel like that's somehow an odd situation. I think they should be killing each other somehow. And so for me, when I see team ups of them, I'm always going like, I don't know. I don't know if they'd actually do that, but it's kind of interesting that that's a good way to tell the stories from different art styles and make things very unique, which I think that's going to be, I'm looking forward to that very greatly. Now, let's say this goes over well. Let's say you get, you know, and I can't imagine you not getting your $500. I think that's going to happen pretty quickly. In fact, you know, I think that'll happen probably by the time this posts, I hope. Do you have other stories in mind, say Monster Hunter for Hire 2?
Oh, certainly. The great thing about Tommy is he can work with any type of story in a sense. Like he works very well here with short stories, but I think he would also work like in a single issue story, self-contained, or even like a multiple stories told over like, you know, two or three issues. I think he's a pretty versatile character in that sense because he's such an everyman. Pardon me. Even though, like, you know, we have a laugh, like the way, as readers, the fact that the admissions don't work out the way he wants, that's entertaining for us to read. But for him, that's absolutely miserable. So he can, but with that, those types of adventures, they lend themselves to short stories, they lend themselves to medium stories, long stories. So yeah, I've got various different ideas. There are so many monsters, both from movies and folklore, that Tommy could go up against, that I'd love to tell more, do more things with him.
You know, there's a monster that I always enjoy whenever I see this monster portrayed somewhere, and it's rare to see. I always like to see Krampus.
Krampus.
From the anti-Santa Claus.
I've been telling my wife, we're getting ready to decorate for Christmas. I keep telling her, I want to get a Krampus and put him in our yard. Let's do that. How about I go get some of those skeleton ponies from Halloween? I'll get 8 of them in the yard, and they'll be pulling a sled with Krampus in it.
See, there was a Krampus comic that I think it was Brian Joynes did, and I interviewed him a couple of weeks ago. And I said to him, what about Krampus? Are you going to do Krampus anymore? He said, well, we always talk about it, but it never seems to come back together. But I always, when I first heard about it, I was really shocked that there was this anti-Santa Claus, you know, because I'd grown up and been many years with Christmas stuff, and all of a sudden out of nowhere comes this European legend about Krampus, and I was like, what is that? And of course, I was fascinated by it because, you know, I never dreamed that had anything to do with Christmas, you know. So I love stuff like that. And just the thought, I mean, if that ever, I would love to see your take on Krampus. That would be something.
I would love to do a Krampus story. That would be really fun. Because Krampus, the interesting thing about Krampus is, as much as he is sort of in our minds, I think everybody at this point knows Krampus, but I don't know that he has broken into like mainstream, like movies or books or comics in the same way of like other characters out there. I don't think he registers to people the same way like King Kong or Freddy Krueger does.
Well, you could do that. I mean, you could be the Krampus guy. Make it happen.
That'd be great.
That'd be fun to see because I there are certain – one of the things I always loved was the X-Files, because the X-Files, one of the things was that Mulder and Scully were forever getting beaten up, which I thought should happen. I don't understand how you monster hunt and you don't get the tar beat out of you every once in a while, because you're facing the unexpected. I mean, there was this one time they were there and they had these little green bugs and they were in a Jeep and these bugs got into the Jeep and of course they couldn't get out. And the next thing you see, they're in the hospital chewed up to bits. And I thought, yeah, that's the way it ought to go. It shouldn't be that you know what to do every time. When you come across the unexpected, you should be surprised once in a while. So I liked that. That was the one I loved that about the X-Files, that they had those weird and wonderful things in that show. I kind of missed that show sometimes. So
it was good.
That was something. I mean, what did you think? Was that something that you liked
from the X-Files?
Yeah.
I guess I never thought about that at the time, and I only watched the first couple of seasons of that show.
Ah, okay.
I think I liked it best when it was sort of an anthology where each story was kind of self-contained, just something different. And it wasn't always aliens. Toward the end, it seemed like everything had to do with aliens. But the early ones, there were stories where they were dealing with ghosts and kind of otherworldly just monsters, not even from outer space, just weird stuff, not of just this reality. And those are my favorite stories. Like, I remember one story where Mulder, I forget the beginning of it, but Mulder runs into this, because it was always Mulder believed and Scully was the skeptic, and it always worked out that she never saw it really happen. So there's like one where he runs into this building and there's this guy being strangled by a ghost. He's just floating in midair being strangled, and Mulder sees this and he's just stunned, and then the guy just drops down to the ground lifeless, and that's when Scully walks in. What happened?
Of course. Yeah. I always like that. They did one episode. I don't want to get too far off in the X-Files, but they did this one episode. There was no monster. And, you know, I had read short stories people had written about X-Files, which was the Mulder and Scully show. They wanted them to get romantically involved, which I never wanted. And I'd always tell them, where's the X-File? And they said, well, there's no X-File. That's a surprise. I said, no. It's called the X-Files for a reason. You have to have an X-File. Oh, no. I think it should be Mulder and Scully. I told her, no. That's not how this works. But there was one where they actually didn't have one. And they're standing outside this like body of water at the end. And they say, well, I guess there's nothing this time. And they walk away. And as they walk away, up from the water pokes this like Loch Ness monster type thing.
Oh, nice.
They completely missed it. And I was like, oh, I said, that I liked. That they missed it for once. Stuff. Anyway, we're off track with this, but as far as Monster Hunter goes, I think there's plenty of choices out there that you could have put your take on that would be fun to read. I'd like to see more of these, to be honest.
Yeah, he's a sort of character. It's like just throw him in a situation and just see how he reacts, and that's where the fun comes in. Like, okay, let's take Tommy and throw him in the depths of hell. And how's he going to handle that? Because I don't think he's going to be scared. I think he's just going to kind of shrug his shoulders like Al and be like, all right, well, it's Tuesday.
So let's see what happens now. I mean, you know, I would imagine Tommy is probably as familiar with all the horror literature.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure he is.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see, because it'll be funny if he runs into something that reminds him of of something that he's seen before, read before, read about. Of course, that sets up a surprise if he doesn't go the regular route. So that'll be good. So it won't be long before this will hit. The only bad thing, I wish this was coming out just in time for Halloween. But there's no bad time.
That would have been fun.
Yeah, but
this is true. This we get some. Yeah, get some horror right after Halloween. My thought was I'll get this started right after the election's over, because then we'll have some fun. That'll all be behind us. But that didn't work out.
No, it's a horror anyway. We have plenty of good horror.
It fits with that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it fits like a horror thing. But I'm fascinated to see how this goes. I'm dying to read the stories. And I did back it. I just want to let people know I have backed it. As I keep telling people, unfortunately, I have run out of room to store physical copies of things. So these days I tend to go for the digital, just so I can read it and have it and keep it on my computer. I have more room on my computer than I do in my room. So I'm going to do that for the moment, but I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be great fun.
I hope you like it.
I should. I really am. I always like the way that you categorize all the different levels. You know, Hunter for Hire is one, Digital Slayer, Digital Whaler for the Moby Dick. That includes the Moby Dick stuff, which I like. And Slayer.
I had fun with those. I kind of played around a bit and tweaked a bunch of things. Like, I think I like this better. And yeah, anyway.
Yeah, I like
way
that.
More thought into those than I should have.
Well, I like the, I'm trying to look for the most expensive one. Hunter with absolute legendary status. That's the $70 or more. Let's see, your name on the cover. That's what you were talking about. Those good things. You basically everything you've ever done is included in that. So that's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. Get all those good things. And you only got people have to be careful though, because you only got three of those. So people better get down to business and start to do it. Even though it's not finished until December 4, don't wait until then, because we don't want Matt here to have the daily heart attack when he looks on and nobody has pledged since he last looked on. We want to get this done so we can have the fun of doing the stretch goals and making those good things happen. So all those good things. Now, are there other things you're working on, Matt? Is this keeping you pretty busy? It sounds like Moby Dick is still going on too.
Yeah, I don't want to stretch myself too thin. Yeah, I've got this, and we still have Moby Dick. And then, you know, in a few weeks, not just a few, it's going to be several weeks. But by the time this latest issue finishes, it'll be time for another Kickstarter for Moby Dick. Mm-hmm. But on top of that, I do have my own podcast. If anybody does want to check it out, it's not horror related, but mm-hmm. it's called Tales from a Small Town Journalist, where I was a journalist for a little community newspaper for almost 10 years. And it's just I interview other people that I have worked with and got to know, and some people that I didn't, just telling their stories about what it's like working in the news for just a little small town, because those are the ones where you have newspaper stories that are just bizarre and mm-hmm. goofy and silly, the sort of things where they say, you know, that could have only happened in my town. So
yeah. That's so true. I grew up in a small town in a suburb of a what they call a sea level city in Pennsylvania. And it was just the oddest things, you know. There was people watching a afternoon soap opera, and this car was driving down Main Street, and he lost control, crashed right into the house and killed the people watching the soap opera.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, and I remember everyone was saying, boy, I'll teach you to watch soap operas. And you shouldn't do that. So that's the kind of thing that happens in a small town like that.
Yeah. One story that I told on this was, I was at my desk and I looked up, and I just happened to look up at the right time at my desk faced a window that looked out, and you could see, Main Street. Like, you could almost see the town square. The town was that small. But there's Main Street, and the first thing I see just trotting down the middle of the road is a cow, which that's weird enough. And then like a few seconds later, about four vets are chasing after this cow on foot. And then a few seconds after that, I see four cops all on foot chasing after the vets. And I looked back, my editor at the time, he sat behind me, and I saw that he saw this too. And I just said, I got to go out there and take pictures of that, don't I? He said, yeah, you better get out there now.
Sounds like a Benny Hill skit.
That made the front page the next day.
I'll bet. It sounds like a Benny Hill type skit. You know,
it very nearly was. And yeah. And then I felt really guilty because by the time I got there, they brought the cow in without any trouble. I asked one of the vets, like, what was he at the vet for? And they said, oh, he was getting castrated. Like, oh wow. Good. Now I almost wish I was rooting for him to get away from here.
Okay. If you ever want to hear a great cow story about something like that, if you ever read James Herriot's books.
Yes, I have read those.
There's the one where he has to get semen from the one, and he has this dry wit, and he puts this bull or basically in a restraining thing, and he puts a cow in front of it, and of course starts to get all excited, and just as things are about to happen, he reaches around and tries to aim for this tube to get things into, and the way he describes it, the bull turns around, looks at him like with this absolute look like, how dare you do this indignity to me kind of look. I read that like 2 a.m. and I'm dying laughing. That subtle humor that always makes me laugh. I just thought that was great. But you're right. The small town stuff is always great fun. So how do people listen to it? How do they get to it?
Oh, it's anywhere you listen to podcasts. And I also post every episode on YouTube if anybody wants to find it there. But okay. iTunes, what other ones are there? Spotify. You can find it on there. Tales from a Small Town Journalist.
That's great. That'll be good. And you have a website too, though, right? For all the other stuff. What's the name of your website?
It is Matt Shore. That's MattShorr.net.
And isn't there one Back from the Deep or something? Is that the Moby Dick one?
Correct. Yeah. Moby Dick has its own URL, backfromthedeep.com. Wanted that to be as easy to find for people as it possibly could be.
So, and if people want to follow you on social media, how do they do that?
All right. You can find me on Twitter at TheMattShorr and on Instagram at TheShorr. And my wife and I have a Facebook page that we maintain called Shore Manor Studio, which also has all of my comics and just our quirky adventures. And of course, speaking of Halloween, we share all of our Halloween decorations because we are avid home haunters. We've just moved to a new neighborhood this year, and we went all out on our yard decorations in spite of the pandemic.
Super cool. That's great stuff. So again, it's Monster Hunter for Hire, and it's on Kickstarter. Again, it's going to conclude on Friday, December 4th at 1:43 in the afternoon Eastern time. And don't wait. Now is the time to get out there and support it. After you listen to this episode, be sure to get out there and support it. Well, Matt, always good stuff. Always great to talk with you. And I'm so looking forward to this and reading these great stories. I'll have to be in a good spooky mood.
All right. That sounds good.
There's just times I want these kinds of stories, and I'll have it ready for when I do that. So keep it up. And again, folks, Monster Hunter for Hire. And it's on Kickstarter now, and get out there and support it.
And that's a wrap for this episode. Until next time, keep reading your comics.